Welcome to a recording from a La Trobe Asia public event. The global geopolitical landscape is shifting towards Asia. It can be seen in China's bold infrastructure project reopening the historic Silk Road and in the maritime success of port cities like Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Asia is rising, but so are its connections to Central Asia, Turkey, and Europe. Perhaps the best word to capture the emerging global order is Eurasian. At the Melbourne launch of his new book, The Dawn of Eurasia, Bruno Massieu discusses the increasing strategic significance of Eurasia, the dominance of China, Russia, and the EU, and how the United States is redefining its place in between. Bruno was in conversation with Dr. Ewan Graham, Executive Director of La Trobe Asia. His visit was supported by Adelaide Writers' Week. It was held at the State Library of Victoria on 7th of March 2019.
So I'm delighted that we've been joined tonight by Bruno Massieu, who is coming towards the end of his visit to Australia. Bruno was until recently a senior advisor based in London with Flint Global, but now has made the move to Beijing, where he is, among other things, a senior fellow at Renmin University, but also has an affiliation back to the Hudson Institute in Washington. He's well known from his official career as being the Europe Minister in Portugal from 2013 to 2015. He was a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and at the Carnegie Institute and Brussels. So his footsteps have taken him, I think, well and truly throughout the Eurasian canvas that we're here tonight to discuss on the back of Bruno's new book, which at the end of our conversation tonight will be available outside for Bruno to sign in the lobby for those who are able to stay on and to buy a copy. I thoroughly recommend it. It's a fascinating read, and I think we're going to have a really good conversation around some of those themes. My impression, Bruno, welcome, is that, if you like, the genius of the way you've approached the book is that it is a deceptively light read, and I mean that in a good way, that this is geopolitics, but geopolitics that's accessible to a lay audience, which I think is important. A lot of us have lost the art of looking geopolitically at the world throughout the long post-Cold War period, when non-state actors, terrorism in particular, was the dominant security lens through which people looked at the world, and some of that focus has been lost, including within governments. I think it's good that you're reintroducing that vocabulary to us. I also like the fact that although you're selling a particular narrative around a revived Eurasia, it's not done through any kind of supremacist lens. You're not putting Asia on a particular pedestal. There is a vogue for doing that. But I think your approach is also commendably subtle in blending these various poles of power throughout this Eurasian landscape. So I'd like to start with a few questions to lead us through a conversation, and then allow plenty of time to you in the audience to ask your own questions of Bruno. And maybe just starting with this, that your vision of a Eurasian supercontinent with diffuse borders is a very alluring one. But how does this square with the decidedly 19th century view of the two largest states in Eurasia, China and Russia, which make up the bulk of its landmass and power? Even if Russia and China stick together, doesn't their attachment to a kind of 19th century hyper-sovereignty place fundamental constraints on how far that integration can actually proceed?
Good evening to everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. Not necessarily, I don't think so. I think the world we're entering is similar to 19th century Europe on a grand scale. I sometimes think that if we want to understand the world today, you have only to make a rough analogy to 19th century Europe. In place of Russia, you have China. In place of Prussia, you'll have Russia. In place of France, you'll have the European Union. And instead of the United Kingdom, you'll have the United States, a bit separate from Eurasia, involved in its affairs from a distance, an island on the shores of Eurasia. And that also means that it's a very competitive world, but very integrated. 19th century Europeans called themselves Europeans, but their worldview was a worldview based on competition against the other main poles, the other major powers. I think the remarkable thing about Eurasia today is that it is a very constricted place. You have these great powers looking for space, looking to expand their worldview, and so clashing against each other in a space that is looking smaller and smaller. If you think about the European Union, if you think about Russia, if you think about China, I would say all of them are universalist in nature. All of them want to change their neighbors in a certain direction. All of them want to shape a new Eurasia according to their own ideas, according to their own rules. And then we also have to add smaller players, Japan, Iran, and of course India, who may be part of the main group soon enough. And so it's a very dangerous game, but a very exciting game. I would say the moment we're in is a moment when Eurasia is already integrated in many respects: trade, infrastructure, finance, even culture to some extent. But it's not politically integrated. So again, similar to 19th century Europe or to 18th century Europe, where the continent is a single whole. Lots of people think of themselves as being part of that single whole: artists, financiers, businessmen. But politically, it's very fractured, with many competing projects of how to organize it. In Europe, we had 100 or 200 years of struggle about how Europe should be organized. Only today, with the European Union, is the question settled. And I suggest in the book that we should get ready for 100 years, or a bit less, or a bit more, of Eurasian conflict for the final shape of the supercontinent.
You laid out there the players involved more than just Russia and China, as I alluded to, but you talked also about India and Japan. So it's naturally a more multipolar environment. But just to focus in on one of those competing visions, the Belt and Road Initiative, which I know is something that you've been working very closely on, and indeed have written another book on. Is China's Belt and Road Initiative more a cause or a symptom of the increasing importance of Eurasia, in your view?
I think it's a project to organize Eurasia. So in that sense, it is a symptom. It is perhaps the first major power that realizes that this is where the fate of the world is going to be decided. And when you look at the maps of the Belt and Road, what you see is a certain vision for the future of Eurasia. The United States has disappeared to the other side of the map, has become an island. And Eurasia is a little bit what the Roman Empire was. There are roads, they all lead to Beijing. There are railways, there's deep integration, but the center is Beijing. So in that sense, after writing this book, if I wanted to be logical about it, I should write a book about China's plan for Eurasia, Russia's plans for Eurasia, Europe's plans for Eurasia, America's plans for Eurasia. So be four books, which I may end up doing, but at least I wanted to write one of them. It seemed to me the most important: China's plans for Eurasia, and that's my second book.
The terminology Belt and Road has replaced the One Belt, One Road. When you said all roads lead to Beijing, I think that was the kind of perhaps unintended symbol in that original formulation of One Belt, One Road. Do you think that in branding terms, how one actually formulates these competing visions makes a good deal of difference to how persuasive they are?
Yes, that's a very interesting discussion which I've had in Beijing with officials. The name has changed. In Chinese, it was always Itailu, One Belt, One Road, and it hasn't changed. In English, it was called at one point One Belt, One Road, a direct translation of the Chinese. But as someone explained to me in the State Council in Beijing, that made it look like too limited, too simple, that it was just one specific project. They wanted something more, something vaguer and more expansive, that could change and shift with time, and even perhaps a bit more mysterious. And so Belt and Road, metaphorical in its very definition, I think they were attracted to that. By the way, in Chinese, Yitai Lu, One Belt, One Road, is metaphorical. It's only when you translate to English that it becomes a bit too technical. One belt, one road. So they want something that is metaphorical. And in the book, I compare it to the concept and the idea of the West, which is also a metaphor, but a metaphor that became the representative of a certain global political and economic order. So sometimes people say the past equivalent to the Belt and Road is the Marshall Plan. I don't think so. I think the past equivalent to the Belt and Road, and it's not just past, but also present, is the West, the idea of the West, which the Belt and Road deliberately wants to replace.
Within the Belt and Road, there is the Silk Road, predominantly the land dimension, but there's also the maritime Silk Road. And I'd like to interrogate this idea of Eurasia a little bit more from alternating continentalist and maritime lenses. And I think towards the end of the book, you certainly declare yourself as an enthusiast for land. Are you, in a sense, a man kind of after Alfred Mackinder's own heartland? It seems to me that your confidence about those connections across the Eurasian landmass, that they can trump those over water, depends not only on the scale of geopolitical ambition, but more prosaically and fundamentally on the economics of transportation. The maritime empires of Portugal, of Spain, France, England, Holland, were all founded on that physical fact that maritime trade and its military analogue sea power were able to outflank overland caravans and armies. Has technological change flattened the earth to a degree that it makes Mackinder's domination of the heartland viable now in a way that wasn't the case in the 20th century?
Right, it's an interesting question about the relative importance of sea and land. By the way, I think Belt and Road, really, if you want to translate it into non-metaphorical or less metaphorical language, you could call it land and sea. The belt is the land part of the initiative, and the road is the sea part. And I'll explain in a second this apparent paradox that you actually call the sea route a road, and you call the land route a belt. It's very easy to explain. But so the relative importance of these two geographies, these two spaces. Some authors are obsessed, fascinated by this contrast between land and sea. I never quite understood that. There's a famous and very polemical thinker, Carl Schmitt, that wrote a whole book dedicated to his daughter. So it's in some respects almost a child's book, explaining the relative importance of sea and land in the history of mankind. I think it's important here in Australia because you consider yourselves essentially a sea nation. I'm less convinced that this is a critical distinction. In the second book, I'm very interested in ports as the connection between land and sea, and in particular as the connection between industry and transportation, because I actually see that transportation will continue to be essentially seaborne. But what happens on land that doesn't happen on sea, and here I try to answer your question more directly, what happens on land is industrial development. I even wonder if, as we moved from the Portuguese and Dutch empires, we were also, to the British Empire, we're also moving from commercial civilizations to industrial civilizations with the Industrial Revolution in Britain. As you know, it didn't happen in Portugal and it didn't happen in the Netherlands. And the British Empire was, I think, much more land-based than the Portuguese Empire. We never left the coasts. What happens is that in the Belt and Road, industrial development is really critical to the Belt and Road. And that happens on land. That happens through the creation of industrial parks and through the creation of corridors or belts where different parts of a single geography can specialize in different things. the vision that China has is not that different from the vision that you have today in the European Union. You have belts of economic development. In the Czech Republic, cars are assembled. Some of the most valuable parts are produced in Germany. They move back and forth across corridors of transportation. And you build these nodes of specialization in different components of industrial products, and then you connect them, and you're able to develop value chains across borders. And China is trying to do the same on a grander scale across Eurasia with new transportation links and also with industrial development through industrial parks. So in that sense, I do think that maybe one could argue that land is more important because it's where the next industrial revolution is going to happen. And China is, of course, very interested in leading the next industrial revolution of automated cars, robotics, artificial intelligence, and biotechnology.
You reference Australia as a sea nation. It may actually be more accurate to think of it as a beach nation. But it's an unusual country, and maybe at the end we can come back to some of your impressions on this visit. But being both a continent and an island nation as well, as it leads to some interesting paradoxical identities and expressions of that identity. But on that theme of technology, that reminds me that in your chapter on Chinese dreams in the book, you talk about the contrast between Western and Asian experiences when it comes to change, specifically as asserting that individuals in Asia have a much more personal relationship with it. For example, while Westerners have gradually been exposed to computer technology since the 1980s, many Asians' first experience with a computer came in the form of a smartphone, and they may have grown up without electricity, as you illustrate. Do you think this gives Asian countries an advantage in terms of adapting to and embracing technology? And if so, what impact might this have in the military strategic sphere?
Yes, I think in some sense, now if you want to see the future, you have to go to Beijing. And it's the reason I live there. Just before coming here, I went to have dinner with my wife. We went to a restaurant where the chef and the cooks were robots, and the waiters were robots as well. I think the robots did a good job. The waiters did a good job. I'm not sure about the cooks, to be honest, but maybe they'll get better. I wasn't impressed. Where everyone uses the cell phone to make payments. And I think this is even more important, I'm always struck by how a country that was rural, provincial, agricultural-based, for my linea, the migrant workers coming from the countryside into the city, they adapt so quickly and so easily to the taxi drivers. They use, of course, the app, equivalent to Uber. All the payments are done electronically, and it's actually... it's been more difficult for me to adapt to that than these migrant workers coming from the countryside. The country is in love with change. The country is comfortable with change. Take a high-speed train from Urumqi to the Gansu province. Again, people that have lived in those villages forever, they are so comfortable taking a high-speed train. You board a high-speed train in China in about 7 minutes and a half. And this is, we're talking about, in some cases, 2,000, 3,000 people. And I'm thinking, in Portugal, it would take about 2 hours for 2,000 people to board the train. But, you know, the discipline and the concentration and being comfortable with change and being comfortable with technology. And I try to explain why, and I don't have a final answer. It's one of those questions that I also left a little bit for later. I'll have other opportunities to try to answer it. But I think one possible explanation is that Asians, I think it's true of Japan and Korea, to a greater extent of China, had to do in the space of a generation what the West did in the space of 300 or 400 years. And that's very important because these fundamental dramatic changes in the West, they sometimes happen beyond the lifespan of a single individual. So that actually during the lifespan of your life, things were relatively stable. And it's over two or three generations that the changes were dramatic. So no one really saw the very dramatic changes. I think in South Korea and in China, extraordinary dramatic changes happen through the lifetime of a single person. And that kind of, I think psychologically in China, it kind of broke psychologically the whole of tradition on the Chinese mind. And now everyone is just like, let's do it. Whatever happens, happens. But let's move towards this scary but exciting future.
As you mentioned, Japan was the first real modernizing experiment in Asia. Korea, sort of in conscious emulation of that model, shortened the timeline considerably. And now China seems to be breaking those records yet further. But just to bring geography back into those three examples, China obviously, in its own identity, has a Middle Kingdom mentality. South Korea is an unusual appendage to the supercontinent in that it is a peninsula geographically, but because of politics, it's a virtual island. But nonetheless, it has a clear Asian-leaning identity. But Japan is an island country, and I wondered if you think that, having mentioned Japan early on as a Eurasian country, is that an assumption one can take for granted? Do you think that that identity is shared in your conversations with Japanese officials and ordinary people? I know it wasn't part of your travelogue in the book.
Well, I think, of course, Japan is where you should start if you're interested in these issues, because it's the country in Asia that that first realized that you'd have to become modern. And that's so many great Japanese novels about this problem. That you could not remain a traditional society because you would disappear. Such was the power and the drive of the modern Western civilization. And that created a dynamic that was very destructive, I think, in Japan. Because in Japan it took the form of imitating the West, imitating the outside forms of the West, imitating technology, imitating material power. Many writers, I would recommend Tanizaki as the start, have speculated about the destructive impact this had in Japan, of course, until 1945 and the self-destruction of the country. But the way it was solved after 1945 is a way that is very different from China. Japan accepted that it would live under the protection and the hegemony of the United States. So when people think, it's very common today to make an analogy between China and Japan, to say, for example, that China will have a financial crisis similar to the Japanese one, or it will stagnate, and what some people regard as the problem of China will go away. There's a critical difference that Japan accepted, being defeated in the war, that it would be part of the American world, very prosperous and very developed part, but part of the American world, and China does not accept that. And so what do we have now? The trade dispute. You could compare it to the trade dispute that happened in the 80s between the United States and Japan. But in the 80s, it was solved because the United States made it clear, your security depends on us, and we'll solve this trade dispute in a way that is satisfactory to us. Those were the Plaza Accords in 1982, I believe, with Reagan. They're not going to be Plaza Accords this time around. China is going to fight, and the United States is going to fight, and both of them are going to fight back. And I think we're in for something very different from the 80s and with Japan.
As you mentioned, the United States there, which you have an interesting symbol, looking at it as a mirror on Eurasia, a shapeshifter, I think you also call it. But to jump forward and preempt the inevitable question about President Trump, which I'm sure has dominated all of your lectures so far, but I'm going to ask one that you have introduced yourself into the narrative by saying towards the end of the book, and I quote, "If Obama pivoted to Asia, Trump has pivoted to Eurasia." Can you elaborate on that?
I think Trump has become a symbol of important changes that are happening in America. This is the book I'm working on now. Has America become less European and less Western? Is America finally developing its own distinctive civilization? For the past 200 years, I believe, or at least until very recently, America existed in the shadow of Europe. As I read for the next book, the 19th century, America existed in the shadow of Britain, economic and financial. If Britain wanted to send a message to the U.S., they could. The financial control over the American economy was complete. Many people are not entirely aware of this. And then in the 20th century, there was still a lot of cultural influence and European cultural hegemony over the United States. And I think it's only really, let us say, in the 60s and 70s that the United States starts to take a turn away from this traditional Western European world. And with Reagan, things are more different. And for Europeans like myself, the story is a story where the American president looks stranger and stranger every time, with a little exception, maybe with Obama. Because Reagan, we can't believe that he's there. Then George W. Bush would say, oh, wish we had Reagan. And now with Trump, we'd say, well, can George Bush come back? And I actually think that after Trump, we'll get something more dramatic than Trump in terms of a new America. And this is an America that is giving up on its plan to make the whole world look American. It's an America that is trying to preserve its power, to constrain the power of its major rivals, but an America that is becoming less liberal, an America that is treading its own path. And I see Trump, whenever he shows any sign of geopolitical understanding, which in some cases may not be him, in other cases may be intuitive. That's always a problem with analyzing Trump, that you want to analyze it, but at the same time you feel a bit ashamed to attribute to Trump very sophisticated ideas. But sometimes those ideas are instinctive, and I think they are in the case of Trump. He's shown a certain ability to look dictators in the face and see what the role they can play, without this evangelical disposition that Europeans always have, and an ability to play Europe against Russia, which he has been doing consistently for 2 years, and play. I think soon he'll be trying to play Russia against China. To try to balance power in Eurasia, rather than being focused on Europe as a sort of a prolongation of American ideas.
Indeed, it's a criticism of Donald Trump that he seems often to be visibly more comfortable in the presence of strong men and dictators than he is in with democratic allies. Now, he has a well-known relationship with Russia, which is a segue to that other important player, which we should ask you about. Do you think Russia's unique history and identity astride Europe and Asia, does that mean a rejuvenation in the Eurasian age? Or will the development of new economic corridors to Russia's south, particularly those under Chinese auspices, run the risk of bypassing and diminishing Russia?
There's two countries that I'm very interested in the book, obviously, Turkey and Russia, because they are countries that are straddling Europe and Asia. They were always countries that struggled with this. They were on the periphery of Europe. If I'm right and we're entering a world where Eurasia is integrated, perhaps it will be the case that countries like Turkey and Russia will have a second lease of life and find themselves much more comfortable in this new world. Now, as a critic of President Putin's regime, I don't think that will happen under Putin, but the book is not about the next 2 years. The book is about, to some, maybe I'm being a bit too immodest here, but sometimes I'm actually trying to look at the world 50 or even 100 years from now. And I think Russia will feel more comfortable in this world. You already see some signs of that. So Russia doesn't want to abandon the West, but it wants to position itself in between Asia and the West as a bridge between the two. That's now a very enviable position. In some respects, it imitates Europe, but in other respects, it's already openly imitating China. On internet governance, for example, the news from the past week is that Russia is embracing the Chinese model of internet governance and internet censorship. And then the way Russia has been moving into the Middle East, trying to control energy sources in the core of Eurasia, with a view, in my opinion, of being able to look east, look west, play one buyer against another, be able to manipulate energy prices because Russia will control all energy sources and it will be able to sell to China or to Europe. And to play one buyer against the other. Clearly, Russia is interested in occupying this central position in Eurasia. And rather than looking to Europe, looking to integrate itself in Europe, it seems clear that Russia wants to occupy a leading position in the center of Eurasia, where the Middle East is included.
Now, as I said at the introduction, one of the beauties of the book is that it works both as a travel book as well as geopolitics. So just to get into some of the characters that you meet during your journey, including Vasiliev, the Russian archaeologist from Astrakhan, Mahanad, the Jordanian trader living in Yiwu, China, and Maria, the Slavic woman from Kentau, Kazakhstan, whose ancestors migrated from the Ukraine many generations before. Do you consider these to embody quintessential Eurasian qualities or attitudes? And I ask you that because I think it would be a fair assumption that those who maybe are more sceptical of the idea of whether there is a Eurasian commonality, that this is just too large a spread of real estate to really hang together as a coherent concept. So if you just join up your own that kind of micro-level experiences with the broader picture.
The book came out of a very long journey, 6 months, starting near the Caspian Sea and then going all the way to Vladivostok and then back to Central Asia over 6 months, trying to investigate this idea of Europe and Asia, but looking at other things on the way, not just completely obsessed about that question. The characters are, I think, the main reason I wanted to have these characters is to show people in the West, people in Europe, that dreams are being built in other parts of the world, and complicated lives are being lived, and human experience is being felt sometimes more deeply than it is felt in Brussels or Paris. So I wanted to show that there is a more complicated world that people there think. And I also wanted to show that some of these characters, they wouldn't think about Europe, Paris, or Berlin a single second in their lives. Their eyes and their dreams are turned elsewhere. And what happens many times is that they sort of crisscross Eurasia. There are people in Russia that are looking to China, but there are people in Russia that are looking to Europe, and there are people in Kazakhstan that are looking to Turkey, and people in Turkey that are looking to India. So as these life stories intersect, by the end, you have this map of Eurasia with lots of crisscrossing lines, which is the idea I want to convey, rather than the image which some people have in Europe. And I think it is intelligible to you as Australians that everyone would be turning their eyes to Europe and all the lines would be going there. And that's no longer the case. I think actually the book has been more successful showing that that is no longer the case through the characters and the stories and through the arguments and the ideas.
You are European, after all, and from the extreme western extremity of Europe at that. Have you found it more difficult to sell the concept of Eurasia within Europe than you do within these other places that you've mentioned?
Of course, that's a good question. I many times make the comment about the reaction I get when I talk about Eurasia. When I talk about Eurasia in Russia, people are happy. They think it is a Russian idea, and it is true that the word is popular there. When I talk about it in China, people are very interested and want to hear more, and there are books appearing on bookshelves about Eurasia. When I talk about Eurasia in Europe, people are very disturbed by the idea. They don't like it. They think it's scary. They don't want to stop being Europeans. They think it's special to be European, and they don't want to dilute that identity. When I wanted to be really provocative, and when was that? When the book came out in the first week, and I wrote a few pieces for newspapers, when you really want to create trouble because it helps the life of the book, I wrote a couple of pieces saying that Europe is disappearing, it's being replaced by Eurasia. And that sends some people in Europe into a kind of shock. But it's maybe not surprising, because after all, we have to realize that this idea of Europe was built, and I explained this in the book, as a kind of a sign of privilege. We are better, we are more advanced, and it's the Europeans that invented Asia. They invented Asia as the anti-Europe, as combining all the things that Europe had freed itself from. The myth is a myth where Europe emerged from Eurasia into the light, leaving Asia behind. And then Europeans throughout the centuries, 18th, 19th, were supposed to look to Asia as a way to say, look all that we have achieved. We are not like them. So it's not surprising that even today that way of thinking persists.
Okay, great. I'd now like to take it over to you from the floor. I just ask you to identify yourself, wait until the mic comes, and then keep your question or comment as brief as possible so that we can get as many responses from from Bruno as we can.
Thank you. David Olson. I'm a lawyer that's got an interest in this area. You've been travelling around Australia, talking to lots of people in Australia. I'd be interested in your views as to what you think we think about Eurasia. You know, we talk about China, we talk about the Indo-Pacific. We don't, as a foreign policy point of view, have any Eurasian strategies. And I just wonder, you know, whether you think we think about that, should we be thinking about it, and how might we go about developing a strategy?
Of course. For reasons that I think you can guess already, I think Eurasia is a prime, Australia is a prime candidate to becoming a Eurasian nation. I tweeted when I arrived in Australia that sentence, that Australia can become the first Eurasian nation in history. And then to my utter shock, as I was reading some essays in this wonderful new journal that's been published in Australia called Australian Foreign Affairs, AFA, there was an essay discussing some of these issues, and there was a quote from Paul Keating, your former prime minister, in 1992 in a speech he gave, where he says Australia can become the first Eurasian nation in human history. So I was both glad and a bit upset. Now, this is kind of obvious as an idea because Australia is this contradictory country in the sense that your history, heritage, is so deeply connected to Europe that, as I saw in Adelaide, maybe less common here and in Sydney, some people told me that their mothers or grandmothers still talk about Britain as home, even though they haven't ever been there, or they have been as tourists for a week. So this heritage is, of course, present, and it's not going to disappear next year. Your alliance is with the United States, Security Alliance, but then your geography, especially if we want to get rid of this idea of a fifth continent, you are in Asia, or at least your neighbors are Asian. I think your closest neighbor is Indonesia, not New Zealand, right? Correct? I would imagine it's very easy to see looking at the map. And your connections to China, economic connections, are growing and becoming more and more important. So you have these two poles, and the challenge is how to balance them. And clearly, the idea of Eurasia as being a combination of Europe and Asia would be appealing for an Australian. In the book, I have 30 seconds. In the book, I have a section where I try to talk about the pioneering nations of Eurasia, and I give two examples, Singapore and Hong Kong. And I think Australia has the ability to take this even further, this idea of Eurasia, and do what Hong Kong and Singapore have done with huge success on a grander scale of a country of 24 million people.
I just wanted to jump in because in official terms, Australia has adopted a new geographical frame of reference, the Indo-Pacific, which I'm sure you've heard a lot about in the last few days, but just interested in your impressions of that, because it does seem to have grown very quickly to have been adopted, actually first in Australia, but now Japan, of course the United States, to the extent of renaming its Pacific Command, the Indo-Pacific Command. Are these contending narratives?
No, for me, they're the same, and when I see the idea of the Indo-Pacific becoming so popular, I see it as a reflex of the idea of Eurasia. Indo-Pacific is the naval equivalent of the maritime and in terms of security, naval equivalent of Eurasia. After all, the Indian takes you all the way to the Suez Canal and to Europe. And it would be a bit pedantic to insist on talking about the Mediterranean Indian Pacific. With Indian Pacific, you already have the arc of Eurasia, the Eurasian littoral, well expressed. I had dinner yesterday with someone I admire here in Australia, Rory Metcalf, who I think is one of the creators of the concept, and we talked about this, and I think we agreed that Indo-Pacific and Eurasia are talking about similar things. To some extent, I think the way it's so popular here has to do with this maritime island worldview that Australia has.
Other questions from the floor? Lady at the back.
Hi. I'm not sure how loud this is. You mentioned that the belt refers to the land and the road refers to the sea. Could you clarify that?
Right. I was starting to do it, but I didn't do it completely. So on land, you can have a belt, which is a space, is a corridor, a space of deep economic integration, where there will be different industrial parks separated from each other, where people even can travel and move. I'm sure you can think about a belt in Australia, all the area going from Sydney to Melbourne, which then will have suburbs and will have middle cities that link the big cities. You can do this on land, create a corridor, which China has done very successfully at home, and now they want to export the concept. On sea, you cannot have a belt by definition. What you can have is just a communication between two endpoints, because a belt or a corridor is more about the space in between the endpoints than about the endpoints. It's the space that you want to develop. A road is a communication between two endpoints. And so on sea, it actually makes sense to talk about a road. You see how it's not contradictory at all. Because on sea, you're just going from point A to point B. But on land, you are connecting point A to point B and developing the space between A and B.
As a maritime person, I have to jump in on that by saying that you also have flexibility to move at sea anywhere you want between within reason between point A and point B. The problem of your fixed infrastructure on land is if that road is closed, then you lose your connection. Another question. We'll take those two gentlemen together, actually, if we can do that, if we relay the mic between them.
Thank you very much for your talk. My name is Michael. I'm a student from Melbourne University. My question is, in terms of from your travels, who's leading the world in bringing up generations that are culturally bilingual in terms of teaching education and language, not only across Asia but across Europe, mainly in terms of second language speakers and those that are well equipped to travel around the world and be informed in these conversations, as opposed to just taking in the mainstream media, which is this hysteria between great powers?
Yes, so I think in my book, I talk about a very competitive space and supercontinent, but there's also space here for combining cultures, mixing cultures and worldviews. And I think this idea of Australia as a Eurasian country could mean that. I think it's already true that Australia is the place in the West that has a better understanding of China, and this could be developed. I know there's a debate that I been exposed to in Adelaide about teaching school children here Mandarin, and I think that would be important. Clearly, the situation we have now is not sustainable. You have a major world power, which will soon be the world's largest economy, a great civilization, a great literature, and a great history, and the rest of the world's or large parts of the rest of the world exist as if this country was a separate universe. People don't speak the language. We don't know the most basic cultural references about China. So this is clearly a situation that cannot be maintained, and the next generation has to change this, has to open the doors that are closing the communication between China and the West in particular. And if Australia can do something in that respect, I think it would be a great lesson to the rest of the world.
Bruno, I'd like to flip that around, and I know that this gentleman, if you just be patient for a moment. Isn't that also a blind spot for China, a weakness in its ability to export itself as a point of attraction across Eurasia, that it is culturally, it has been introverted, it's very homogenized. It's not the only country in Eurasia that is ethnically homogenized, but it is less so than others, like Korea. But nonetheless, I think there is less of a tradition of looking out in China than there has been in other parts of Eurasia. It strikes me also on that question of cultural bilingualism, one of the original meanings of Eurasian in colonial Singapore was to be of mixed parentage as well. The idea that those people had the best of both worlds in a kind of very literal sense. Just interested in your thought, whether you accept that is a weakness for China in particular.
Yes, that's where the word comes from, in fact, is the people of mixed descent in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Malacca, Portuguese and Chinese, they were Eurasians, and in India as well, Brits and Indians. It is a weakness to some extent, but there's a different narrative there that I would tend to favor. It's true that China was never westernized, and it's perhaps the only country that was never really westernized. And you see that in everything, that even the signs, the sign language you use, the gestures you use are that you think are universal in China, you discover that they're not. Especially if you get out of the big cities, you're in a taxi and you do this, and the taxi driver will look at you and ask, what are you saying? Because, you know, even basic, almost immediate, almost bodily signs have not been absorbed. And I think that's one reason that China is now in a position where it wants to create its own world order, because it never really absorbed the Western. But that's a different thing, right? Because I think there's actually a lot of cultural openness and curiosity about the world in China. We shouldn't think that the fact that China remains a very different culture with different cultural coordinates, that means they're closed. They just operate with a different worldview, but they are open to other worldviews. And I think it's indisputable, whatever you think about this, is indisputable that Chinese in general know a lot more about the West than the West knows about China.
You've been very patient.
Thank you, Bruno, for your insights. Just continuing on, well, David, and even the previous question, are we as Australians taking enough steps to make our own mark in a future Eurasia? And if we aren't, what tangible steps can governments, businesses and individuals do?
Difficult question. In the book, when I talk about Hong Kong and Singapore, I talk about them as being able to understand different worlds on their own terms. I think the success of Hong Kong in particular was that you had people there, genuine Eurasians, not just in a racial sense, but in a cultural sense, who knew that China and the West were very different, and they understood them without trying to reduce them to the same. They knew how the Chinese political and economic system operated, but they were very good at understanding how finance in London operated, and they brought the two worlds together. So that's one sense in which Australia could become Eurasian, that you could be the country that understands China on its own terms and understands America and Europe on its own terms, and benefit enormously from that, because China and Europe simply don't understand China, and China, to some extent, does not understand the West. So that's one meaning, which I think is one that it would be easy to reflect in active policies. Another meaning would be where you actually try to combine this, but I'm a bit skeptical about that. How do you combine these two worlds that are opposites? You can combine cuisine, you can combine demographics, you can combine architecture, but to combine the political systems of China and the West is not something that one can see how it could be done, or that it even is a desirable goal. So I would focus more on the first goal of trying to have understanding of different worlds on their own terms. And this is about politics, it's about culture, it's about language. And I already see this here, by the way. I see a much higher and deeper understanding of China in Australia. I've had meetings by coincidence. I've led seminars at the Treasury in London, in Canberra yesterday, and in Washington with people from the Treasury Department. And the level of understanding in Canberra is incomparable to the very low level of understanding in London and about how China operates. To just continue on that path would be my initial, without having thought deeply about this, would be my initial recommendation.
Who else has got a question that they would like to ask? That gentleman.
Carl Lindbergh. I've been interested in Asia for a long time, but you are very positive in your views of the future. I haven't heard the word military used yet. Where do you think that can cause troubles to your nice plan?
Yes. If you read the book, you'll see that there's many moments in the book where I ask that question. Oh, it is there. Where I ask that question and where I'm worried about the future. But I do think the world we're entering is a world of intensified conflict, but new forms of conflict. It's such an integrated world. I think, you know, what they said about the 19th century, that countries were too integrated to go to war, was not true of the 19th century, actually. It was very easy to disengage. You could do it in weeks. But I think it is true of the world today. But that doesn't mean that countries won't go to war if you define war in different terms. I think we already have a trade war that is ongoing. We have information wars that are ongoing. I think we already, if you follow the news, have something that would deserve to be called infrastructure wars for the control of infrastructure. And we have, above all that, a technology war. We know that very soon we'll have an entirely new industrial revolution with overwhelming new technologies, and there's a war going on about who will control those technologies. So even if we're in a world where military conflict may be avoided, and we may be always on the brink of it but capable of avoiding it, I think it's a world where it will be very difficult to separate peace and war. The natural state seems to be a state in between peace and war, where nations communicate and have economic relations, but where they are competing in a way that is not the competition of the last 50 years for markets. It's a competition for power, economic power, technology, infrastructure, trade. All that seems to me to be developing rather fast, and the China and the United States are an example of that right now as we speak.
Okay, we've got a time for at least one more question. The row behind.
Hi, Johannes Knutik, a student of international relations at the University of Melbourne. I was just wondering where you would position India in the world that China is trying to build, considering its size and its own interests.
India, I think I've been criticized in some reviews for not having, I have a chapter on Turkey, a chapter on Russia, a chapter on Europe, and a chapter on China. There was the question of whether I had neglected India a little bit. I think it's true, and Indians accept this, Indian decision makers, that India is not quite at the level of participating in this great game. It's getting ready for it, but it's not at that level. It's still struggling with domestic problems of organizing state power and state structures, of eliminating poverty, and many other struggles, which stop it from playing an active global role. But two notes on India very quickly, because of course this would be the topic for its own book, but two notes. First of all, never assume that India is Western. The fact that it is democratic does not mean that it is Western. The way it looks at the world is not in any way the Western way of looking at the world. And if it will be an ally of Australia and the United States, it will be a very complicated and ambiguous ally. And I'm not sure even that it will be an ally. And second, that India is entering a very dangerous period, I think. And I'll focus on the economy. India is now faced with a world where America is turning inwards. Just 3 days ago, it canceled the benefits for Indian exports that had been there for decades. And there's really no reason to do that, because India is not a developed country yet. Where Europe is too far away, and very, very limited economic links. Where China is sucking out the air from Indian economic development. And I think it's difficult to see where the space is for the kind of fast economic growth that India needs. So I'm puzzled about what India will have to do to solve what I think is a much more difficult international arena than China faced, if it wants to go through the same process of fast growth that China went through.
Time for one quick one, if anyone has a burning question. If not, then Bruno, it just remains to thank you for being so gracious with your thoughts and your time, particularly at the end of a very congested schedule. I'm glad you found time to work in Melbourne and stop with La Trobe Asia. It's my role to make Australia more cognizant of Asia, both vectors of opportunity, but also of the glass half empty side that the gentleman alluded to earlier. That is the contradiction of Asia, is that it is both vectors of opportunity, but also vectors of threat that sit on the doorstep. And that, I think, will be the dominant challenge for Australia, certainly for a generation, if not longer to come. But also connecting back up with where you come from. I'm British too, from that other side of the Eurasian continent, that we are grappling increasingly with those similar issues, despite the distance between us. And I think that certainly does come through from some of the grand connections that you posit in the Dawn of Eurasia. If anyone hasn't read it, I thoroughly recommend it. Bruno has kindly agreed to stay on for a little longer, and books will be available for signing at the outside in the lobby. Remains to thank you, Bruno, and could I ask you please to show your appreciation as well.